Hey, it's Connor Hall, senior producer for Wrongful Conviction, with another case update and more behind-the-scenes insights. And today, we're talking about a case that, for me, was about as difficult to cover as only a few others. Namely, Brendan Dassey, Rodney Reed, Leonard Peltier. It took me about 6 weeks to produce the final episodes in each of those cases, and also for this man here, Keith Lamar. I've been speaking with his advocate, Amy Gordeev, since about 2021, and at that point, the task was just too damn big. We're talking about 5 murders, one of which happened separately from the other 4, and all of the alleged witnesses gave their statements while in prison. I mean, some are still in there. Some probably never spoke to a defense attorney, let alone a journalist, given their own culpability. So we were going to need reinforcements. And over time, the team at Levine, Beldock, and Hoffman got involved and did a lot of the heavy lifting. And they were able to build on Keith's previous attorney's work, piecing together all the ways in which each of the witnesses in this case had changed their stories along the way and then benefited from doing so. And as I understand it, a number of other folks, some of whom I've become aware of in the past couple of years, have come forward about the part they played in this case. So we're looking forward to that information being presented to the court, as Keith is quickly running out of time. His execution date is set for January 13th, 2027, and Governor DeWine, once again, has a chance to step in and grant some sort of relief. Perhaps those running to replace him in November 2026 will take up this issue and state their intentions for Keith and the death penalty in general in Ohio. I mean, it's not news to any of us here that the criminal legal system in Ohio is deeply troubled. Now, after you hear Keith's story, maybe you'll agree that there are enough problems in Ohio that it's hard to trust any conviction, especially those on death row, because the stakes are so high, a lot of corners get cut. Now, originally this was a 2-parter, but I edited it down to just 1. With some voiceover, I get to the heart of the matter a lot quicker while preserving the details. And some of those details will have you wondering how some folks sleep at night.
On Easter Sunday, 1993, inmates at Lucasville Prison in Ohio took control of an entire cell block. The crisis that became known as the Lucasville Prison Riot lasted 11 days and claimed 10 lives, including one of the prison guards. When the cell block was finally surrendered, an investigation ensued aimed at bringing the riot leadership to justice. After several rounds of interviews, 5 names emerged, including a man who lived on that cell block named Keith Lamar. According to the state, Keith had allegedly commanded a team of men who murdered 4 supposed snitches before heading out to the prison yard where the authorities ushered all the inmates into another block that was still under state control. Then, while confined in a cell with 9 other men, he allegedly ordered 1 more death. The other inmates weren't telling this particular story in their initial interviews, but by the time of Keith's capital trial, they were all somehow singing the same tune. But this is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today's guest is somebody I've been waiting for a long time. His story, as terrifying as it is, it's also the stuff of legend, because this is a man, and Keith, I'm talking about you in the third person, but I'm going to talk directly to you now. Keith, you have had a life that if somebody wrote it into a movie, nobody would believe it. And this is a guy, now I'm back to talking about the third person, who has performed concerts all over the world from inside of your cell on death row.
Bizarre when I hear you say it, you know, but yeah, it's been a hell of a journey, man, to say the least. And this situation that I'm currently facing has only focused me more on trying to get as much life out of my life as I possibly can.
Yeah, I mean, despite fighting for your very life from death row, which is literally hell on earth, your pursuit of art and life seems to have only gotten stronger. And like I just mentioned, you've put on this spoken word and jazz concert series called Freedom First. And if that wasn't enough, you also put out an album by the same name. But there's even more.
You know, there's books, documentaries, book clubs, and so on and so forth. I just wake up and try to do as much as I can with the time that I have, you know, which is what we all should be doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know a lot of people out here in the free world who are living as much as you are inside the literal living hell of Ohio death row. And we're going to get into all of that in more detail later on. And we're also going to be hearing from one of your attorneys, Keegan Stefan, as well. But now I just want to turn around first and start from the beginning of your life. You were born and grew up in Cleveland, right?
Yeah, I was born in 1969 on the east side of Cleveland, Ohio, in a small little enclave called The Village. You know that old saying, it takes a village. I think for the people who founded this little place took that seriously. My grandfather, Harry Lamar, bought his own home in this little enclave. It was made up of people who were in one form or another related. And, you know, during dinner time, you can walk into any number of houses and, you know, people will let you sit down and eat dinner with them. There was no distinction about the economic status because everybody was pretty much on the same level. And that's where I really grew up at from a baby until I was around 7 or 8. My mother met and married a man named Larry Morris. And shortly thereafter, we moved out of the village into the inner city, basically.
I mean, the village sounds pretty amazing. It seems like an odd choice to leave. What were the circumstances?
Well, my grandmother, she was the matriarch of our family, pretty much said what went and what didn't go in our family. And my stepfather didn't like that. And so he moved so he can kind of run his own household. But he was a side order chef at a country club working for meager wages. And so that was the first time in my life that I ever remember being hungry. And sometimes, you know, the lights would be off, the gas would be off, and we had to heat the house with, you know, keeping the oven door open and whatnot. And we weren't allowed to tell my grandparents about this. To him, my brother and I, we were just too extra miles to feed. I had 2 paper routes, cutting grass, shoveling snow, you know, did all those things. You know, a pair of pants might cost $50, $60. And this was before Air Jordan came out, but tennis shoes. It was just out of my range as a kid, trying to do it the legitimate way. And, you know, kids are brutal, man. You know, you show up with some knockoff Jordan-ass jeans and you may as well came to school butt naked, you know. The ridicule was severe. It's all arbitrary bullshit, but you don't know that when you're a kid. And my brother, when I was 10, who was 12, he was hanging out with older kids. And, you know, he had undergone the same ridicule as I did and had quickly opted to become a thief and been sent away to juvenile. And so I was 13 by then, pretty much by myself. And started hanging with a group of older kids in the neighborhood. And one day we all piled into a stolen car and a police officer got right behind us. And we was in this high speed chase, like going 80 miles an hour down a residential district. And I was actually relieved when I got caught, like, thank God. And we went before this judge and he lined us all up. It's about 6 of us all together in our families. And he went down the line and he was giving guys 6 months for each offense that they had. And he'd say, Joe Bruce, this your 3rd time in front of me, 18 months. Joe Butler, this your 2nd time a year. You know, and he got down to me, he said, Keith Lamar. I said, what are you doing hanging with these bad boys now? You know, and he gave my mother and my parents the options. You either take them home and deal with them or I'll deal with them. And, you know, my stepfather told him, you deal with them.
And your mother didn't have anything to say about that?
You know, ideally, that's what you would have hoped for somebody to intervene. But she had already been broken to the point where she accepted somebody like this as her husband. You know, any man is better than no man. And as it turns out, he was like a monster. He was, you know, very abusive guy.
How long was your stint in juvie?
6 months. But I was 13, so it felt like 6 years. Believe it or not, compared to the situation I lived in, it wasn't so bad. I had 3 square meals a day. I was in a structured environment. I came out of it. I was on the honor roll.
And who knows? Maybe you could have kept going in that direction had you returned to a more stable, you know, home and life.
When I came home, I came home. My parents had moved into a 2-bedroom apartment as if my brother and I had went off to the army or something, that we weren't coming back home. And so we moved up into this uninsulated attic. Was freezing cold in the winter, scorching hot in the summer. And we were pretty much put on notice that we were on our own, beyond our bare necessities that we would not be provided for. And I was 13 still when I came home. I think I'm going to have to start selling marijuana, weed. I bought 2 ounces of marijuana, and I didn't look back, man. That was the beginning of the end for me, yeah.
But what about your brother?
My brother had found a means of escape. He met this girl named Paula, who lives in the suburbs, and her mother took a liking to my brother and allowed him to move in with them, and he was going to school in the suburbs. So it's me basically by myself now. I'm 14 years old. I'm selling marijuana. I'm so serious about it, too, because I figured this is my only way out. And I became very good at that. I had about 5 or 6 guys working for me and everything, selling marijuana on street corners and whatnot. And I came home one day and discovered that my stepfather had been up in my room and had found one of my stashes of money. Not long after that, my stepfather kicked me out. I was 15 years old. And I moved into the projects. And this was around 85, 86, right around the time crack cocaine started trickling into the ghetto. Nobody really knew what it was, how dangerous it was. By the time I was 16, I had a Mercedes-Benz, Cadillac, driving Porsches, BMW, Rolex watches. But around a year or two, about 1988, all the detrimental effects of crack cocaine really started to become clear. Guys I grew up with were becoming dope fiends, and young women were selling their bodies. And
as the crack epidemic wore on, the community became increasingly desperate, affecting even Keith's childhood friend, Kenyatta Collins.
You know, he and I grew up together. We used to walk to school together, play basketball together. By the time 1988 rolled around, he was hooked on crack cocaine. Fell in with a group of guys that used to go around robbing drug dealers.
And on December 2nd, 1988, Keith was at the apartment when Kenyatta and the stick-up kids showed up.
And guys were forcing their way into the apartment. I was shot twice myself in the legs. You know, I shot a Kenyatta twice as he came through the door. I woke up in the hospital, and I was right next to Kenyatta Collins. I heard the doctors when they pronounced him dead. And, you know, I woke up again, and I was chained to a hospital bed. And once I was able to walk again, I went to the county jail, and I bonded out.
I mean, this is not a legal opinion, but your actions in this incident sure sound like self-defense in the purest sense of the word.
But I didn't have access to the old self-defense laws because I was selling drugs. My hands weren't clean.
Right. So what was your attorney's plan?
This attorney came to me on the eve of trial and told me, you know, that they were going to try to put me on death row. And since I was so ignorant of the law, I didn't know that they elevate the crime in order to entice you into taking the deal. I pled guilty to murder, but it really should have been manslaughter. You know, I was in a state of defending myself. No forethought or malice or anything went into it, so it was manslaughter. You know, he convinced me that that was in my benefit to cop out. They gave me 18 years of life. And I remember the judge saying, you know, don't worry about it, son. It's only 12 years, 6 months to the parole board. But, of course, he didn't tell me about the danger I was wading into. They sent me to Lebanon, Ohio. It was 3 major factions that kind of controlled the resources inside the prison. The Black Ancient Disciples, Sunni Muslims, although they don't consider themselves a gang, and the Aryan Brotherhoods. It's the first like, building kind of a racism that I had. You know, the N-word, you heard it constantly, ringing around the clock. N-word this, N-word that. But I'm talking about by staff, not just by the prisoners. Since we were down in Southern Ohio, the Aryan Brotherhood were being armed by the guards who worked there, some of whom were in the Aryan Brotherhood. They had swastikas on their necks. And after hearing all these war stories of young guys like me being raped, you know, I kind of fixed my mind that that wouldn't happen to me.
But you didn't join the Sunni Muslims or the Black Gangster Disciples, right?
Oh, you presume I wasn't in the Aryan Brotherhood.
Oh, my God, how rude of me not to have thought of that.
Right,
I mean,
right.
I'm sure their invite got lost somehow.
No, I never got an invite. But the first thing I did when I came to Lebanon, I joined a boxing team. You know, once, twice a year, you have a boxing match in front of the whole prison. You can show everybody what you're made of, and people can form their opinion after that as to whether or not you are easy game or whatever, you know, but I got my GED and then enrolled into the college program. So I was on the trajectory in terms of preparing myself for this parole date.
And staying out of a prison gang was part of that plan, which continued after Keith was transferred from Lebanon to Lucasville in 1991, which was arguably a more difficult and violent situation because of a truly tragic incident involving an adult education teacher who worked at the prison.
Beverly Taylor was her name, and she was murdered by a black prisoner. Calls for the guy to be executed were being put forth by the community. But the guy was mentally handicapped and was deemed ineligible for the death penalty. So they didn't get what they wanted. And so ultimately, a new warden was appointed, a guy named Arthur Tate. And I think around 1991, Arthur Tate instituted this thing called Operation Shakedown. And he started kind of turning the screws, tightening up on everything. You know, you have to have your shirt tucked in at all times. You got to walk on the right side of the hallway. It was more or less like a military camp now. You know, something that happened overnight. He set up this P.O. box. If you wanted to drop the dime on somebody who wanted to become a snitch, you just put an anonymous note in the mailbox on your way to chow. All the various factions were being pitted against each other. And you can kind of cut the tension with a knife.
And there was one incident in particular that kind of pushed the whole thing over the edge.
They came up with this tuberculosis test. And apparently had an alcoholic substance called phenol that the Muslims strenuously objected to. And the warden, Tate, gave them an ultimatum. You either take the test or we're going to make you take it.
So April 11th, 1993 was Easter Sunday, and Warden Tate planned on forcibly injecting the Sunni Muslim population on Monday, April 12th. So the Sunnis devised a plan to seize control of an entire cell block by taking advantage of the skeleton crew that worked on the holidays. Now, to give you a lay of the land, Lucasville Prison sprawled out in four directions, like a wheel with four spokes. One spoke encompassed maintenance, the hospital, and dining hall. Walking from there toward the center, you'd meet up with the other three spokes, J block to the right, K to the left, and L block straight ahead. Now, K and L both consisted of a long hallway with a gym at the end and eight wings to the sides, L1, L2, and so on. Keith lived in L6. It was about 3 p.m. when Keith and the other prisoners were in the yard between K and L block when the Sunni Muslims saw their chance and struck.
Recreation was just about to end. They called over the intercom, 10-minute warning, where everybody started lining up to come back inside the prison. And while we were standing in line, a guard ran out with blood streaming down his face. And he was followed by a masked inmate carrying a nightstick. And he's saying, "We're taking over, we're taking over." You know, I'll never forget it. And it was just around 30 minutes or so, they had took over the whole L side of the prison.
And they later barricaded themselves into L Block and held it for 11 days. But at this point, Keith was still out on the yard and had no idea what was going on or what was to come.
News started to trickle out that they were, you know, ransacking the cells and everything. What was actually happening, they was going from cell to cell, accumulating food, telling people that they had to donate whatever food stuff that they had so they can administer it during the ensuing days. But the word that reached us on the yard was that they was robbing the cells. And so it was with that misinformation that I, against my better judgment, decided to go inside and check on my personal belongings.
And this decision to go inside L Block was how, eventually, Keith's name got dragged into what happened on L6.
When I went in, I kind of immediately understood that, you know, this was something more involved than just one prisoner attacking a guard, because they were breaking windows, fire alarms was going off. I mean, it was pandemonium. And, you know, I made my way to my assigned cell block, L6, and in contrast to the chaos that was going on in the corridors, it was very, very quiet. You know, guards were already locked into the shower stalls, and there was different prisoners inside of the cells who I later learned were hostages. But I didn't know that at the time. I came in and not really understand. I ran down to my cell, and there was a person inside of my cell. And so instinctively, I ran up to the control panel trying to unlock my door so I can get this person out of my cell. Because as far as I'm concerned, that confirmed what I already kind of figured, that somebody was rifling through my things. but it, you know, he was a hostage. I went up to the control panel, was turning the knobs randomly, you know, not really understanding how to work the panel, and opened up a few other doors inadvertently, and, you know, that alerted the Sunni Muslims who were inside the pod, and they accosted me and told me, you know, on certain terms that, you know, this is what's going on. You either with us or you get the fuck out of here. And, you know, I chose to leave. I left and came back out onto the yard.
Keith was ultimately accused of killing four men during his short trip inside L Block, the hostages being held on L6, who, according to the state, were snitches. At this point, I want to bring in one of the attorneys representing Keith. He's an associate at Beldock, Levine, and Hoffman. Keegan Steffen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Keegan, the state's narrative of what happened on that awful Easter Sunday in 1993 obviously diverges from Keith's version of events. But let's start with where they are the same.
You know, Keith was not in L6 when the riot started, even by the state's theory and narrative of events. Second, you know, this riot was very deliberately planned by a group of people that Keith was not a part of. And again, the state concedes that, which seems like a very important point.
Right. But now the state disagrees with what we've already heard from Keith.
Yeah, so that's where their stories diverge. Keith goes in to get his belongings and leaves. That is what numerous alibi witnesses say. The state says that he goes in and then forms a death squad and executes the people that have been locked in their cells.
And this death squad was allegedly made up of Keith and four or five others who brutally murdered four alleged snitches that were being held hostage on L6. Daryl DePina, Albert Stayano, William Svetti, and Bruce Vitale. But what did they say was Keith's motivation for this?
The state says that it's effectively a bargaining chip, that if he forms this death squad and executes these alleged snitches, then he can get out of L6. He can leave. You know, people who staged the uprising have said that Keith would not have had that power, that they wouldn't have let that happen, that this wouldn't have been a bargaining chip to let people leave. So it's inconsistent with what was going on in the prison, and it's inconsistent with what Keith was doing. It's inconsistent with numerous alibi witnesses. It's only consistent with the stories of the people who testified against Keith, who were obviously highly motivated to testify in that manner.
And later on, we'll get into the testimonies of those receiving either leniency, shorter sentences, immunity, a transfer, or most of the above. But first, let's get back to the story from Keith's perspective from when he returned to the yard and the prison was in full crisis and chaos mode.
I mean, helicopters were flying up above over the prison. And then gradually the National Guard showed up, the Ohio State Patrol showed up, and they took up stands around outside the perimeter fence. They had their, you know, machine guns out and riot gear, their riot helmets and everything. And so we're thinking, this is only a matter of time before they regain order. And an hour would go by, 2 hours would go by, and then the bodies started coming out. You know, a group of mass inmates would come out of the building, waving what looked like to be a machete. And it was surreal. Then they had the body on the yard. 10, 15 minutes would go by, and someone from the administration, a medic or whatever, come and retrieve the body and take it back through the K-side area. 30 minutes ago by, another body. Then another body. Another body. Then it started getting dark outside, started getting cold. And then eventually guys started setting bonfires, you know, out from the wood, from the boxing ring. And you got to understand, you know, the boxing ring was my sanctuary. This was the place where I went to kind of, you know, make peace with all the bullshit that I've been through in my life. You know, I'm tearing the boxing ring up, trying to get wood so I can start a fire because it's chilly. It's April, but it's chilly at nighttime. So we're standing around the fires and everything. And all while this is happening, the Highway Patrol, the National Guard, just standing there watching. By now, I don't know, 5 or 6 bodies have been brought out to the yard, most of them dead. The people whose job it is to stop me from being one of those dead bodies are standing on the outside of the fence. And it's inevitable that you take in the notion that shit, one of these bodies could be mine. Around 3 o'clock in the morning, the Highway State Patrol came out, guns drawn, and ordered all of us to line up to enter the K-side gymnasium. Once we got inside of there, they stripped all of us naked, took all our clothes and made us sit down in the middle of the gymnasium floor, probably about 400 people or so. And we stayed there like that in total stark nakedness for hours, it seemed like. Eventually, they started taking us random groups of 10 and escorting us to these single man cells. So they put 10 naked individuals in these cells the size of a closet, if my recollection is right. I'm in K236 with 9 other naked individuals.
And in that cell, the fifth murder happened. And the state says that Keith ordered the murder. You know, Keith says that there was a confrontation and that he had nothing to do with it.
When they finally came around and gave us jumpsuits, not long after that, threw sandwiches in the cell, which was the first time many of us had eaten since the whole ordeal started. It was like a feeding frenzy. Some guys took more than their share. And Dennis Weaver, he was one of the older prisoners in the cell. And he, you know, held on to his dignity and refused to kind of join the fray and made the mistake of saying something about it to this guy, William Boland, guy named Shabazz. And Shabazz put him in a chokehold, and these two other prisoners held his feet down, you know, because he was struggling, trying to free himself. When the authorities came to remove Dennis from the cell and tried to question us, I, along with most of the guys in the cell, said that we were asleep, which was our way of saying that we didn't want to be involved, because that's one of the things you learn in prison, to avoid violence by minding your own business. And we don't know at the time that by not saying anything, we allowed the guy who actually committed the murder to shift the blame. You know, he said he was forced to kill Dennis by me and several other individuals.
You know, it's a pretty wild leap to go from someone not telling you the complete truth, from someone saying that they were asleep to saying that they ordered a murder.
It's also obviously hard or impossible to order a murder when you don't have a weapon or the clout of a prison gang behind you. But that's what the state and its cooperators ended up saying Keith did once the riot thus settled and many rounds of interviews began. But at this point, the instigators of the riot were barricaded into L Block, armed with the prison's hostage negotiation handbook and 8 hostages, making demands while anticipating the authorities' moves. On Wednesday, April 14th, a sheet was hung from a window threatening the death of a hostage if their demands were not met. Among those demands were food, water, electricity, access to the news media, a stipulation regarding any future medical testing, the hiring of more black guards, the relaxation of day-to-day restrictions, and various quality of life improvements, as well as the removal of Arthur Tate. Now, early Thursday morning, April 15th, the body of one of the hostages, 40-year-old prison guard Robert Vallandigham, was produced from L Block. He had been strangled to death. The negotiations continued. A few hostages were released. And finally, on Wednesday, April 21st, a list of 21 demands were met to solidify the surrender of L Block. In the end, 10 men had died. Earl Elder, Franklin Farrell, Bruce Harris, David Summers, Daryl DePina, Bruce Vitale, Albert Stayano, William Svetti, Dennis Weaver, and of course, the prison guard, Robert Vallandigham.
And so the guard's murder is what really drove the prosecution.
So let's talk about the investigation led by Hamilton County prosecutors Mark Pietmeyer and Seth Teeger. We remember their names from other wrongful convictions, including Elwood Jones, who they were totally willing to send to death row, even though they had scientific evidence of his innocence. So you could draw your own conclusions from that, as well as what you're about to hear.
The riot was presided over ultimately by the Black Gangster Disciples, the Sunni Muslims, and the Aryan Brotherhood. Right. The goal was to put the leadership on death row.
It's remarkable the number of interviews that took place and the number of times the same incarcerated people were interviewed and how much their stories changed. Most of them did not identify Keith in their early interviews and even affirmatively said that Keith was not involved. And then at a certain point in that arc of giving statements, they all started identifying Keith. Something shifted there and he became a very easy scapegoat.
Well, the Aryan brother here is represented on death row. The Sunni Muslims are represented here on death row. The only people who are not represented here on death row is the Black Gangster Disciples. Guess where they're at? They're right now walking the street because they testified against the leadership of these other gangs. And I'm the fill-in for the Black Gangster Disciples. It's an open secret. I mean, it was an article that was written on the 30th anniversary recently in Cincinnati Inquirer, and the prosecutor, Mark Pietmeyer, is on record. And he said that you know, did I make the deal with the devil? Possibly. It's possible that the guy who maybe had blood on his hands is on the street right now, but that was the cards that we were dealt. You know, that's how the justice system works. It's first come, first serve. And, you know, the guy who Mark Pietmar was referring to in the article was Anthony LaVelle. He was the leader of the Black Instant Disciples. Based on everything I've read, everything I've heard, you know, because it's been 30 years, he was the one who was really responsible for most of the killings, including the guard's death.
And so it appears that the leadership of the Black Gangster Disciples, Anthony LaVelle, Stacy Gordon, as well as others who were actually involved in the deaths on El Block, managed to avoid accountability by supporting the narrative that laid blame for all 10 deaths on the other four men and, of course, Keith.
Never been in the game, but I had a prior record for murder. I was inside of the L6 pod when I came in for that brief time. I wasn't wearing a mask. People identified me, said Keith Lamar was inside the pod. They pulled my record. And recently when we did a FOIA request, we found out that the prosecutor had written his name on my file. Like, this is significant. This is somebody we can use. I had to plead guilty in my original case.
He was already facing a sentence that maxed out at life. Everybody sort of thought he would take the plea. But as everyone who's talked to Keith knows, he's a remarkable individual with the utmost principles, and he was not going to plead guilty to a bunch of murders he did not commit.
You know, one of the things that you don't see on Law and Order and those different police shows on television is that, you know, it's real informal environment. They call you by your first name and, you know, act like your old buddies, like, Keith, come on, we passed that now. We're going to need you to cop out to this and you'll be doing yourself a favor. Otherwise, we're going to put your black ass on death row. Cop out to murder and we'll run the time concurrent with the time you're already doing and be like you're getting off scot-free. I said, but I'm innocent, though. How am I getting off scot-free when you're talking about prolonging my stay in prison beyond my parole date and I haven't done anything? When I was presented with this deal, they said, if you plead guilty, you'll be going to parole board in your early 50s. Well, I'm 53 years old right now. And instead of going to the parole board, I'm facing execution in less than 6 months. I would never spend the last 30 years in solitary confinement. The beatings, I went 20 years without touching my family. I've been on I don't know how many hunger strikes. I would never have to go through any of that had I pled guilty to these crimes I didn't commit. Or had I actually killed 5 people. But if I plead guilty to murder, you're gonna run the time with the time on right. That's a hell of a deal for a mass murderer. But if you stand on your innocence, they say, oh, you want a trial? Okay, we're gonna give you a trial.
And that's where we left off in part one of Keith Lamar's coverage. Instead of taking the blame for 5 deaths and remaining parole eligible, Keith risked death and stood on his innocence and was taken to trial, where he faced an uphill battle. He was tried in a nearly all-white county, accused of ordering 5 deaths during a prison riot. 4 alleged snitches in L6, Bruce Vitale, Daryl DePina, Albert Stiano, and William Svetti, as well as Dennis Weaver in cell K236. And in part 2, we delve into the evolution of the various witness testimonies, something that was impossible for trial counsel. You see, during the discovery phase, rather than handing over the interview transcripts, the state argued that it would be too difficult to locate all the exculpatory statements, which obviously is no excuse to violate a defendant's constitutional rights, so they were ordered to find what they can, which is not exactly what justice demands. And in a 2007 evidentiary hearing, Mark Pietmeyer outlined the incredibly narrow standard by which they deemed something exculpatory. Since these were group murders, if Keith wasn't specifically excluded, well then, that statement doesn't exclude Keith. And it's discovered later that they hadn't even met that standard, where several state's witnesses, who we'll talk about soon, Lewis Jones, Anthony Walker, and Stacy Gordon, did just that. They excluded Keith, but still, their statements were hidden. And it gets even worse. The prosecution argued that the identities of cooperating witnesses needed to be protected. Okay. So they were ordered to provide exculpatory statements without names attached to them. So, if you're following, That makes the statements useless for cross-examination. How are they supposed to be able to impeach a witness if they couldn't present an initial statement in which they had denied Keith's involvement, right? Like, hey, you're saying this now. What about this first statement you gave where you're like, no, Keith had nothing to do with it? And then you can't even like follow up and investigate or, you know, look for a rebuttal witness, right? That's what was allowed to happen. The exculpatory statements were just read into the record without an identity attached, and then 43 names were read into the record as potential sources for those statements, all of whom refused to cooperate with Keith's defense team because they all had something to lose. It was only after other trials or guilty plea proceedings that those statements became available with the names attached, allowing Keith's appellate attorney to do the analysis that could and should have been done in preparation for Keith's trial, placing the statements with their corresponding witnesses, along with the context of what was received in exchange for going along with the state's narrative.
Almost all of the testifying witnesses followed the same arc. Initially, they were not naming Keith Lamar or even affirmatively saying that Keith was not involved. And then over time, as they gave more statements, started saying that Keith was involved and Keith was the leader of the death squad. You know, that is suspicious to say the least. And then almost all the witnesses to some degree also received deals and have credibility issues.
So let's talk about those witnesses.
The testifying witnesses against Keith were Robert Bass, Anthony Walker, Thomas Taylor, Stacy Gordon, Lewis Jones, Ricky Rutherford, and Michael Childers. Many of the witnesses were transferred to Oakwood, which was a much more favorable facility for incarcerated people. Even the witnesses themselves testified that the guards were catering to their needs, giving them unlimited supplies of cigarettes, unlimited supplies at the canteen, extra visitation, jobs, and free range of movement.
But more importantly, almost all of those testifying witnesses had everything to gain. I mean, some of them had flat out admitted to killing one or more of the victims, and then they just shifted blame onto Keith, saying that he made them do it. And being in this better situation together, the witnesses were also able to coordinate.
They went over a script. My ate Thanksgiving dinner with these prisoners. They had movies. They had the free run of the commissary. And these same witnesses were carried from trial to trial.
So Keith was charged with four murders from L Block: Daryl DePina, Bruce Vitale, William Svetti, and Albert Stayano. But let's start with the one from K Block, Dennis Weaver. Keith told the story of how he was piled into this cell on K Block with nine other guys when a Sunni Muslim named William Bowling, a.k.a. Shabazz, killed a man named Dennis Weaver along with two others, Ricky Rutherford and Michael Childers, who ended up testifying that Keith had told them to do it.
We've been able to find affidavits from one of the Muslims who was in the pod with William Bowling after Dennis was killed. And he encouraged William Bowling to say, listen, just say he made you do it. They already saying shit about him about the Elside murders.
And I have that 2005 affidavit right here from Abdul Muhammad Sadiq, who said that he had been previously threatened by Dennis Weaver. And he continued in the affidavit talking about the time he spent in the same cell with William Bowling in the aftermath of the riot. Now, Michael Childers was in a nearby cell as well. Sadiq said that Shabazz admitted to killing Weaver out of loyalty to him, a fellow Muslim whose life had been threatened by Weaver, a non-Muslim. Sadiq told Bowling, and this is a direct quote, that he should join with Childers and blame Lamar for the order since Lamar was a non-Muslim and he was being seen as a ringleader for other inmate murders anyway, end quote.
And William Bowling, when it came time for him to testify against me on trial, he refused to come.
Right, but Michael Childers and Ricky Rutherford did testify. Keegan, what can you tell us about these two?
Yeah, so Ricky testified that Keith was the leader of the death squad, that Keith told him to tie up Weaver and that he did it. And then Keith told Childers to kill Weaver, which Childers did. Rutherford was transferred to Oakwood, where they were given preferential treatment, and was charged with an aggravated murder, but the charge was reduced to involuntary manslaughter. And he received 5 to 25 years, but it was sort of intentionally meant not to increase the time that he would serve. The state also promised to let his cooperation be known to the parole board, provide him with counsel for his appearance before the parole board, and make all of the transcripts available to him.
So Rutherford admitted participating in Dennis Weaver's murder, completely removed William Bowling from the equation, and then, for the small price of saying Keith made us do it, he received a better prison assignment and effectively no additional sentence for the murder.
In addition, Rutherford is one of a couple testifying witnesses who suffered severe mental illness, auditory, visual, and command hallucinations, but those records were never turned over to the defense.
Jesus Christ. Okay, so what about Childers?
Michael Childers first said that other incarcerated people tied Weaver up. Then he said that he was told to kill Weaver, but when he went to do so, Weaver was already dead. Then ultimately, he admitted to killing Weaver, but said that Keith told him to do so. Again, he was charged with murder, but pled to involuntary manslaughter. Childers is another witness who was severely mentally ill. Medical records showed that he suffered hallucinations, and those medical records were not turned over to the defense, so the defense could not argue to the jury that this person was not a credible witness.
And again, the mental illness was the least of the credibility issues. Childers got a huge break in sentencing. Instead of murder, which is a capital offense, involuntary manslaughter, which is what he was charged with in Ohio, means 3 to 11 years. You can see that's a deal he certainly didn't want to refuse. All for the low, low price of blaming Keith for his own actions, alleging that he gave the order like some sort of prison gang leader, like Anthony LaBelle or Stacey Gordon of the Black Gangster Disciples, for example. Now, Stacey Gordon actually testified against Keith.
Yeah, so Stacey Gordon was one of the shot callers for the Black Gangster Disciples, is my understanding. He plainly admitted to helping to plan the uprising and to killing another incarcerated person, and yet was never charged for that. He was charged with assault on a corrections officer, but pled out and received 3 to 5 years to run concurrent with the sentence he was already serving. So he effectively served no time for this assault during an uprising that he admitted to planning.
So he got no time for either the assault or the murder. Wow. All right. So what testimony did he give in exchange for this phenomenal sweetheart deal that he got?
At trial, you know, Stacey Gordon is probably one of the more damning witnesses, and he describes Keith as the leader of the death squad. Again, it's sort of suspicious because other people identify Stacey Gordon as the person doing a lot of the things that Keith Lamar was ultimately pegged for doing, which was opening the cells that the alleged snitches were caged in, which was, in everybody's narrative, including the state's narrative, the step taken to lead to their executions. And it is in just direct contradiction to sworn testimony that he gave at his own guilty plea for the assault on the corrections officer, where he was asked if he saw Keith in L6 and said no.
So it sounds like he subbed Keith in for himself in the state's narrative at Keith's trial. And then the rest of the witnesses appear to serve that goal. A guy named Robert Bass testified, in addition to 3 more men who all appear to have been part of the death squad, Lewis Jones, Anthony Walker, and Thomas Taylor. So let's start with Robert Bass.
For Robert Bass in particular, he did not bring up Keith's name on his own. The transcript shows that one of the interviewing troopers brought up Keith's name, and then Robert Bass started saying it back to the interviewer. And this is like a classic example of a fed fact. But, you know, Bass didn't actually testify to seeing anyone assaulted or killed, but he said that Keith was in L6, that Keith had a t-shirt over his head, but was sure it was him. He also himself admitted to removing dead bodies from L6, but was never charged with any crime.
Bobby Bass, he was somebody who I was on speaking terms with. You know, during the riots, he fell down the steps, he was drunk or something, knocked all his teeth out. When he came to testify on me, he had all brand new false teeth. I mean, he looked at 20 years younger, you know. And he looked at me. He one of the guys that looked at the table, one of the hunched his shoulders like, I'm sorry. And he got released. He got an early release, man.
So he got his teeth fixed as well as an early release in exchange for some super vague testimony saying that your head was covered, but somehow he knew it was you. Maybe he was trying to make himself impeachable. Sounds that way, but okay, 4 down, 3 to go. Let's move on to Lewis Jones, Anthony Walker, and Thomas Taylor. And we're going to do this by going victim to victim in L block. Bruce Vitale, William Svetti, Albert Stayano, and Daryl DePina.
for Daryl DePina, you know, there were other incarcerated people who made statements saying that Lewis Jones was the person who killed Daryl DePina. Lewis Jones' statements changed dramatically over time. He admitted to being a part of the death squad and listed everyone else involved, which is a sort of rare statement for someone to give off the bat for an incarcerated person. But he didn't name Keith. He said that the group was led by a Black Muslim. Lamar was not a Black Muslim. And then ultimately, you know, testified that Lamar was the leader of the death squad. Other incarcerated people identified Jones as being involved in not just the murder of Daryl DePina, but Bruce Vitale. And despite that, despite him admitting that he was a member of the death squad and knew everyone else involved and being implicated in two murders, he was never charged in connection with the uprising in any way.
Wow. He named everybody in the death squad in his first interview and excluded Keith, information that was hidden by the state. And then for his testimony, he was transferred to Oakwood and was not charged for two murders, Daryl DePina and Bruce Vitale. And I understand that another individual, Aaron Jefferson, was named along with Lewis Jones for Daryl DePina. And then there were additional people named in connection with Bruce Vitale's death.
Yeah. So with Bruce Vitale, there is not strong and credible evidence against Keith. However, there are other statements in the record that two other incarcerated people were the actual people who killed Bruce, who were not charged with this crime.
Now, let's move on to the murder of William Svedi.
A person named Eric Gurdy later admitted and pled guilty to this, had to give a colloquy about the details of the murder that had to be accepted by the court. And he specifically said that Keith was not involved. That would seem to be pretty important exculpatory evidence that should be a basis for reversing this conviction, but the courts didn't see it that way.
And in addition to Gurdy, there were court filings naming three other individuals in Svedi's murder, Fred Frakes, Roger Snodgrass, and Brian Eskridge. Yet none of those alternative suspects were known to the jury or the defense. So moving on to Albert Stayano, for this one, the last two witnesses, Anthony Walker and Thomas Taylor, kind of tag-teamed this one.
Yeah. Walker initially told investigators that a number of people participated in the beatings and murders in L Block, but said that Keith was not present. Ultimately, however, he said that Keith was involved, and so he just switched in Keith for other people in his narrative and ultimately testified that Keith was the leader of the death squad. Keith handed someone a bat and told him to when he had earlier said that was someone else entirely.
So this is another time Keith was specifically excluded, but the state withheld it from the defense. And then Walker joined the crowd, swapping in Keith for the actual assailants in exchange for no charges for his own actions. Then Thomas Taylor testified to receiving and using the bat that Walker mentioned.
So Thomas Taylor admitted to murdering Stayano. He said that he alone hit the victim over the head with the bat repeatedly until the bat cracked, but he said that Keith told him to. And yet Taylor was able to plead to involuntary manslaughter while Keith received a capital murder charge and conviction.
Taylor made about eight statements. His first three statements, he was noncommittal. The fourth statement, he said he saw Keith Lamar and Stacy Gordon. He said Gordon is the leader of the death squad. And then his fifth statement, Stacy Gordon completely disappears from the narrative because Stacy Gordon, too, have now become a state's witness.
So it appears through the evolution of Taylor's statements, one could surmise that perhaps he was told to protect Stacy Gordon, while throwing Keith Lamar under the bus meant for the actual murderers. So with this pileup of witnesses and no meaningful way to cross-examine and impeach them, all Keith's defense could do was present alibi witnesses. In addition to those five men, who had corroborated Keith's story that he was out in the yard, Keith should have had the clothes and the boots that he was wearing when everyone else in the yard and he were moved into K Block and stripped naked. If he was involved in the murders on L Block, then there should have been some sort of biological evidence to corroborate or dispel his alleged involvement. But all that evidence was burned, along with a piece of paper that Keith was alleged to have stuffed down Dennis Weaver's throat. So without that, or any of the impeaching evidence that we laid out here today, the jury was left to take the state's witnesses at face value, with no physical evidence to corroborate any of it.
Because they did at one point roll a whole bunch of wheelbarrows and shovels and fire extinguishers and hammers and shanks and all this shit wrapped in plastic as if they had did a meticulous investigation. Shit didn't have anything to do with anything. You know, but no one was there to see that. throughout the whole trial, which lasted a month, there was no one in the gallery. You know, it was empty. And the jury found me guilty. I went back to Lucasville for a month, and I came back for sentencing. And I had, you know, written and memorized this little speech that I wanted to say. And I came out into the courtroom, and it was about 300 white people standing in there. And suits, man, and Easter clothes. I mean, and it was standing room only. And I hadn't seen iconic pictures in the 1800s, 1700s of black people being lynched. And you had this big gathering, big swarm of white people standing around with ties on. It was the same thing. And when I seen those pictures a couple of years later, I knew I'd seen that before. I said, you know, I witnessed that. And I was a part of that. I know what that is. That's a lynch mob. The most important thing I've learned is that who I am is more important than what I have. And if I am who I say I am, then it doesn't really matter where I am. I can still be who I am. I mean, I'm in a fucked up situation. There's no way to sugarcoat that. I've been inside taking fine for all these years, but I am not the situation. The situation is fucked up. I'm not fucked up. I make sure that I'm not fucked up. I have a routine. I've learned how to meditate when I was in my early 20s. And I was lucky. Jason, I met and was mentored by some very remarkable men here in prison, father figures. One was my boxing coach, and this other guy named Ayi was like a philosopher, poet, you know, kind of turned me on to a lot of literature and was like a therapist as well, kind of helped me deal with some of the trauma. And then when I arrived on death row, I met another older guy named Snoop, who I referenced in the music, in the album that we put out, the Freedom First album. You know, these mentors showed me how to do yoga, how to actually live. And, you know, I was able to pursue myself even in this little space. You know, I started developing my inner life. You know, I have a rich inner life. You know, I've read, you know, close to 2,000 books, man.
And I have to ask, Keith, of the close to 2,000 books that you've read, which one had the most profound impact on you?
Well, one of the things that I was given to understand that if I wanted to change my situation, I had to learn how to write. Now, mind you, I dropped out of school in 10th grade. And so one of the books that I read that taught me how to write was Richard Wright's Black Boy. I read that book every day for, you know, a few years. I was reading with the intent of learning how to write. And so reading that is how I ultimately became a writer myself and wrote my memoir, Condemned, which chronicles, you know, my journey through the criminal justice system and on death row.
This is the most important part of the story, in my opinion, right? Of course, I'm talking about your poetry, your performances, music, writing. You wrote Condemned, as I understand it, in solitary confinement on a typewriter a few pages at a time, right? And dictated it every morning by telephone to somebody who transcribed each and every word. You founded a literacy program, learned to play chess, yoga, meditation. I mean, I think most people are listening and trying to think which people from their life, you know, friend circle has accomplished what you've accomplished.
But I'm doing the same that you are trying to do, Jason, that, you know, anybody else trying to do. You're trying to make the most out of your one and only life. And the circumstances are different, yes, but the goal is the same, is to do something righteous with my life.
Tell us, what is Native Sons? That's a literacy program that you founded?
Yeah, the Literacy Project. You know, Richard Wright, as I said, man, had a big impact on my life, not just on my writing, but just on how to engage with life. And I just thought that if I had read that book when I was 13 in a juvenile, that it probably would have change something in terms of my self-concept and how I looked at life. And so I just started reading with high school students in the inner cities here in Ohio and New York City. And it's been really, really a rewarding experience.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's kind of like you're reaching back, almost like trying to help your younger self. And you've been doing that and so much more with one of the unsung heroes of your story, Amy Gordeyev. She helps facilitate the literacy program events. She's the person that transcribed your memoir, Condemned, over the phone, as well as advocated for you to us and Leah Rothman of the Real Killer podcast. She's also the person that facilitates what you mentioned earlier. And I'm talking about Freedom First, which started as a concert series with New York-based jazz musicians and you on the phone from Death Row sharing poetry and spoken word. You've done shows literally, like, it seems like all over the world from your cell. It's really incredible what you've been able to accomplish.
You know, because I have time. You know, these people have given me time, you know, and given me really a gift of time.
It's truly amazing to hear your perspective. And I believe I could come around to it being a gift, if not for the fact that you have to also spend that gift of time fighting for your freedom and your life, your very life. So let's turn to your appeals. There were a number of potential constitutional violations, like whether or not some jurors were excluded due to racial bias. But the main issue was and is the withholding of exculpatory evidence. But this issue is kind of split into two parts. The first, whether or not the way in which the information that was shared with the defense at trial constituted a Brady violation, the landmark Supreme Court case that ruled that the state must turn over all evidence that might exonerate the defendant. And if you remember, the judge read statement summaries detached from their sources.
The appellate court said these statements were turned over. That ignores the fact that they were turned over in such a way that they couldn't satisfy the very basic premise of Brady, that they're turned over in a way to defend yourself.
Right. How was he supposed to defend himself with these sort of phantom statements with no names attached? So how did the ruling get around that obviously clearly logical conclusion?
They said that they weren't exculpatory, which sort of follows the prosecutor's very narrow definition of Brady, which is that they weren't exculpatory because they said that other people did it, but they didn't say that Keith didn't do it.
Which is patently ridiculous. There were plenty of people in that prison, 1,819 to be exact, and they weren't specifically excluded either. And so what did the court say to address that?
They said it wasn't material under Brady. And material under Brady is effectively, if it wouldn't have changed the outcome of trial, then it's not material. And so we don't need to reverse a conviction based on the fact that these statements weren't turned over in a usable fashion.
So that refers to what Pietmeyer and Teeger did turn over at trial. And then comes the second Brady issue, the exculpatory evidence that was withheld from the defense and later discovered by two attorneys who were appointed to handle Keith's federal appeal, Kate McGarry and David Daughton. Now, they turned up the initial witness statements that we revealed earlier, and at least two of those satisfy even the very narrow thread-the-needle Brady standard that Pietmeyer and Teeger devised. Anthony Walker and Lewis Jones both named everyone in the death squad and specifically excluded Keith. And then there's the statements about Stacy Gordon.
There were statements from other incarcerated people saying that Gordon opened the cells that the alleged snitches were placed in and was the leader of the death squad, which is basically what Keith was convicted of. Gordon himself admitted to killing another incarcerated person.
And then was never charged with that murder, but rather with assault of a corrections officer with a sentence to run concurrent, by the way, with the time he already had. And then at that assault proceeding, Gordon specifically excluded Keith.
So that is, again, very clear material Brady evidence.
But the state courts heard all of that and didn't think even one juror would have thought it mattered at the time, even though that's all it takes to change an outcome at trial.
Exactly.
I was told not to expect any relief from the state courts. I thought I would receive relief once I got to the federal court. And I'm the only one out of all the Lucasville prisoners who were granted an evidentiary hearing. We've been back in 2007, I believe it was, and put Mark Pietmeyer on the stand.
And this was when he came clean about the impossibly narrow standard by which they deemed something exculpatory.
Right. I mean, it's a strange thing that the courts did in reviewing those statements, right? They bought Pietmeyer's logic and said that if a statement said that some people committed the murder but didn't directly exclude Keith, then it wasn't exculpatory. Okay.
But Pietmeyer and Teeger did withhold statements that were not absolved by this ridiculous standard, statements that did specifically exclude Keith. And yet the federal and state courts both did the same thing, saying that the statements from Anthony Walker, Lewis Jones, and Stacy Gordon wouldn't have made a difference at trial. So Keith's habeas was denied in 2011, as was the appeal in 2015. And in 2016, the Supreme Court denied certiorari, refusing to review the evidence and the lower court's decision. Separately, there's been an ongoing legal battle over the lethal injection protocol in America. Essentially, the rest of the world is so disgusted by us that they've been trying to starve us of the drugs that were deemed to be, quote, humane, a ridiculous word for this, and approved thereby for use in our lethal injection protocols. And I'm talking about sodium thiopental or pentobarbital, the anesthetic acting as the first drug in the three-drug cocktail. By 2014, states began to run out of the drug, and so they started looking for alternatives like midazolam, which then triggered legal challenges from those facing the death penalty. The thing is, with midazolam, in many cases, the condemned have suffered and writhed in agony on the gurney for the better part of an hour, which one would think would constitute a violation of the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment. But our current Supreme Court did not agree. However, this long legal battle over the injection protocol did have the positive effect of halting executions, even if only temporarily. In the meantime, for Keith, after his federal habeas was denied, he fired his attorneys and his case was given to the Tennessee federal defenders. But with midazolam cleared for use by the Supreme Court of the United States, various states that still have capital punishment began setting execution dates again, including Ohio, which caused an imminent and very real threat to Keith's life that has since been averted. And we'll get to that in a minute. But first, let's get to the Tennessee federal defenders.
The Tennessee federal defenders took over the case. They did successfully get access to additional files that the appellate counsel did not have access to. We're now going to be reviewing those. They were going to attempt to bring an actual innocence claim. They recognized that it needed to happen in state court first, but their jurisdiction is limited to federal court, so they were not able to make that motion. So since then, you know, Keith has needed someone to come in who would be able to make a motion in state court to bring in any newly discovered evidence.
And that's where you and the team at Beldock, Levine, and Hoffman come in.
Yes. Yeah, so David Singleton at the Ohio Justice and Policy Center is our local counsel. And then we're also working with Joshua Jack Jones at Northwestern Law School. We've now gotten all the materials from Tennessee federal defenders. In the process of digitizing all of that, we have an army of attorneys and student attorneys now that are going to be reviewing it in tandem using the coding system to bubble everything up to get the attorneys that'll be writing the brief.
So there are still some promising legal avenues available, along with the potential for additional exculpatory material that you have already. And now, Governor DeWine has granted Keith a reprieve. It's cold comfort, but still. And it's insane that it ever got this close. But Keith had a scheduled execution date of November 16th, 2023. But now his team has a real chance to litigate his case. And we are hoping against hope that justice delayed will not be justice denied. So what can our audience do to help?
You can go to my website, keithlamar.org, or follow me on Facebook, Justice for Keith Lamar. Just petition on those various pages that you can sign that was submitted to the governor just to indicate to him how many people are aware of my situation and who are watching the decisions that he makes regarding my situation.
All right, we're going to have action steps linked in the bio. It's important to note that Justice for Keith Lamar is a nonprofit 501c3. There will also be ways that you can delve even deeper into this case, including another podcast, the entire second season of The Real Killer with journalist and host Leah Rothman. We're also going to link to Keith's book, his upcoming shows, and how you can experience his work and get involved. So with that, we come to my very favorite part of the show. Closing arguments. First of all, I thank each of you. Then I'm going to kick back in my chair, turn my microphone off and leave my headphones on, probably close my eyes, and just listen for anything else you want to share with me and our incredible audience. So Keegan, why don't you go first? Then Keith, you'll take us off into the sunset.
Keith is innocent, and at minimum, he did not receive a fair trial. He needs to finally get a fair look at his case by a court. You know, I think Keith has said it best. He's not asking any attorney to promise that he will get exonerated. He wants us to create a document that lays out his story, shows just how many constitutional violations occurred in his trial, just how much exculpatory evidence there is, and put that in front of a judge and make a judge look at all of that and say, we're going to put you to death anyway. Keith wants his story out there. He wants, if he's executed, this to be something that people look back on and say, look, that shows just how inhuman this system was, just how doomed this civilization was, that it would put people to death based on trials that were egregiously unfair. And I think that Keith's trial was egregiously unfair, and we're coming in to try to right that. Unfortunately, our only method of righting that is to find new evidence outside of that trial, get back into court, exonerate Keith, and stay his execution.
As I'm talking about all this shit, it's a lot too, man, that, you know, to kind of, you know, if you didn't have the statements, if they threw away all the statements like they did, threw away all the physical evidence, no one would believe this story. But lo and behold, this mountain of evidence, you know, all this shit. So for no other reason, the world want to know about this, what happened to me, what they did to me. And it might be, you know, I might find myself strapped to a gurney, but it won't be because I went to death row and laid down and watched their color television. It won't be because I sat down in that cell and didn't open up a legal book, that I didn't do everything that I possibly could in furtherance of my own life. And it won't be because the public didn't know about what they did. But that's what this podcast is about. That's what the book is about. That's what the documentary is about. That's all what that's all about. They won't be able to call this justice. Now, I might not be prevent them from executing me. These people have been killing. They're good at that. They're efficient at executing people, lynching people. And I would join the ranks of my ancestors. That's how I look at that. If shit that happened, I'm doing everything to prevent that from happening, you know. But one thing for sure, they won't be able to call this justice, though. And that's my goal. And so I've been retrying my case in the court of public opinion. And it's a hard sell until you read the evidence. You know, you have it right there in your hand, you know. I didn't have that. The jury didn't see that. Not that it would have made a difference. But we live in a different era now, and I'm hoping that people in today's era, after seeing George Floyd, Eric Garner, Breonna Taylor, so on and so forth, that they would, you know, respond differently to this evidence and not say that it doesn't mean anything. Because obviously, I came to prison and did something with my life. I rehabilitated myself, and if that's what this is about, then I have done that. I'm a perfect candidate for redemption. We all have to be given a chance to learn from our mistakes and become a benefit to our communities and whatnot. I can do that if given a chance, if that's what we say we truly are about. I dedicated the past 2 decades of my life mentoring young people in the same situation I was in when I was 13 years old. And with no incentive, my beard hasn't gotten any softer because of these things I've been doing. I'm doing because it's in my heart to do that. Because I had a recognition that this is what I'm supposed to be doing with my life, in spite of the bullshit that happened to me.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.